This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear from Dr. Alan Radner, the Chief Medical Officer at Salinas Valley Memorial Healthcare System.
The risk of having a serious reaction to the vaccine is like 2 in 1,000,000. You know, your choice is you can get vaccinated, which has almost no risk, or you can get sick, which has a significant risk.
Also, San Luis Obispo County Supervisor John Pichong will talk about redistricting and other issues facing the county.
Currently, the city of San Luis Obispo is covered by 3 supervisors. It may end up being 2 supervisors, may end up being 1 supervisor.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, August 9th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. A line of cars and trucks recently traveled through the Central Coast with a mission to inform farm workers of their labor rights. In this week's episode of Beyond the Furrows, KCBX's Francisco Martinez followed behind to find out why.
In the parts of Santa Maria where green plants and brown soil are abundant, there is a massive truck beaming with LED displays. It's parked on the side of the road, and the truck is blasting messages in English, Spanish, and Mixteco. Close to the truck, Fernando Martinez, megaphone in hand, stands far enough away from the field so he's not trespassing, but close enough to farm workers so they can hear him. He's one of many activists on the Central Coast advocating for farm worker rights. He's a community organizer for the Mixteco Indigena Community Organizing Project, or MICOP. Martinez was spending the 2nd of 3 days caravanning across the Central Coast. When I spoke to Martinez the day prior, I asked him about the caravan's end goal.
The end goal for this would be like farm workers knowing where to go to ensure that, you know, they know how to properly do a report, whether it's like employer not providing water, not providing shade. So the end goal would be to ensure that farm workers are uplifted and informed of their rights.
A 2015 survey from the Central Coast Alliance for a Sustainable Economy, or CAUSE, identified many ways farm workers say their rights are being violated, including inadequate breaks, exposure to pesticides, or working in conditions that are dangerous or harmful to their health, among other concerns. I spoke to one farm worker while I followed the caravan. He has to remain anonymous out of fear of retribution. He's from Oaxaca, a state in Mexico, and is 32 years old. He says he's been working in Santa Maria's field since he was 13. The farm worker says he's trailing the caravan in support because he knows there's a retaliatory nature among agricultural employers because he's lived it.
Bueno, desde que tengo memoria, siempre hemos sido pisoteados.
He says bosses have held down farm workers for as long as he can remember. But he adds that he's grateful to these advocacy organizations for going to the places where his fellow farm workers are to help them know their rights. According to the CAUSE survey, one significant way farm workers are held down is through wage theft. This can include not paying overtime to farm workers, undercounting boxes, or not paying farm workers for required prep work. That same survey finds around 80% of farm workers surveyed were informed of their rights in some way. That means 1 out of every 5 farm workers is in the dark about their rights. I asked Cindy Jewell, the marketing and communications director at Babalu Berry Farms, what she thought about the caravan. Babalu has farms in Santa Maria and owns West Coast Berry Farms in Nipomo, where farm workers went on strike in July over wage disputes.
I personally don't think it's really necessary. I mean, most farm workers that I've ever talked to and seen know their rights, and it's all posted in Spanish and on every ranch and on every picking cart and pretty much explained to them by people they work with.
Jewel says when it comes to informing farm workers of their rights, the challenges are like any other job. Workers not reading postings or relying on hearsay or language barriers. When this happens, Jewel says Babalu reaches out to fix misinformation. On the caravan itself, Jewel says she doesn't think anybody has an objection to workers being informed of their rights if organizations feel it's necessary.
As long as they're not disrupting someone, you know, if they're not encroaching on someone's property and disrupting people's workday, I mean, I guess it's fine.
Those caveats Jewel mentioned are obstacles for organizers. They can't get on the fields to talk with the workers because they would be trespassing on private property. And this caravan is trying to catch farm workers on their breaks, which is a limited time. Lilia Garcia Brower is the state's labor commissioner. She says she's aware of those challenges, but it's still important that the caravan gets its message out so the farm workers can hear the information.
We are not trying to disrupt the operation. We want to support workers are there to work. We want them to complete their hard day's work. But it is helpful when we're able to catch them on a break, and then we provide them that information.
Another challenge is mistrust among farm workers toward governmental agencies. Garcia Brower recognizes this and hopes the caravan plays a role in creating trust. Fernando Martinez also recognizes that challenge. He hopes that organizing joint events, like a caravan, with government agencies helps empower farm workers to advocate for their rights as workers.
I think that kind of builds the trust a little bit more, knowing that, you know, their trusted organizations are working with government agencies in a way that is going to benefit the farm workers. So I think that's my goal, like, eliminate that, you know, the long and bad image of maybe some of the farmers, oh, they don't really help, or they never come around to help us out.
For the farm worker I spoke with, knowing that there are people out there fighting for his and his co-workers' rights gives him hope. He says, thanks to those who have given out information about farm workers' rights here in California, I really like how this movement is going. Next week on Beyond the Furrows, we'll talk COVID-19 and vaccines. For KCBX News, I'm Francisco Martinez.
Our 12-part series, Beyond the Furrows, is made possible by a grant from the Sunflower Foundation. Before the pandemic, Car Week was a major event on the Monterey Peninsula, and now it's back. Throughout the week, 85,000 visitors are expected, adding $67 million to the local economy. KAZU's Doug McKnight has the story.
Chris Shake's office sits directly across from his Monterey restaurant on Fisherman's Wharf. The old Fisherman's Grotto is one of three restaurants he and his family own. Restaurants that were closed or carry out only for much of last year. You can hear the pain in his voice as he relives those days.
The streets were empty. People weren't walking around. There was no business. I've never experienced anything like this.
Finally, in March of this year, Monterey County moved into the red tier, and restaurants could begin serving indoors again. Shake says that was a turning point.
Well, we've seen a huge resurgence. We're getting a lot of visitors, and it seems like it's more business than we can really handle. The crowds are huge here in Monterey. We get many phone calls every day. It certainly has been a lot more than past years.
Some of the Car Week events are already sold out. And if that's not enough to convince you of the excitement of Car Week, try booking a room.
Thank you very much for calling Hyatt Regency Monterey Hotel and Spa. My name is Katie.
I asked Katie if there's anything available through the end, Car Week, on the 14th.
I don't show any availability. The property is currently fully booked right now.
Katie did say there are individual nights available, and a quick online check confirmed that. But here's the catch. If you want to stay in a nice B&B or a major hotel, rooms start at $1,000 a night. While things are looking good for Car Week, don't put the top down just yet. There are storm clouds ahead.
We have seen some research that the Delta variant is causing people to think twice.
That's Rob O'Keefe, CEO of the Monterey County Convention and Visitors Bureau. He says the variant is particularly worrisome for international travelers.
Because different countries have different requirements and restrictions whether they can travel or not.
And international visitors are important, making up nearly 15% of attendees and spending 4 to 5 times as much as the average visitor. O'Keefe says most events are outside, and event producers are requiring masks, social distancing, and even in some cases, proof of vaccination. And he says his organization is doing all it can to reassure the public that while COVID is in the news,
we want to make sure that the headline reads that Monterey County is a safe place to visit. Yeah.
Businesses and their employees are not the only ones looking to Car Week for an economic boost. Cities are as well. Hans Usler is Monterey's city manager.
Our main revenue sources are really depend on the hospitality industry.
In fact, 40% of the city's general fund comes from visitor taxes on hotels and sales. So it's easy to see how the lockdowns were devastating.
We are actually categorized by the state auditor of California as one of the most hit cities in the state, following Anaheim with Disneyland there.
The city is still restoring services cut during the pandemic, so it's looking to Car Week to provide hope as well as a windfall. The city's hotel tax is 12%. Remember those $1,000 a night rooms?
It means for the city that our hotel tax will triple during those weeks.
By the way, if you're a local and want to avoid Car Week, the county has a webpage with events each day and links to traffic cams so you can navigate your way around. So buckle up.
Case rates of COVID-19 are rising in the Monterey Bay Area due to stagnant vaccination rates and the Delta variant. KAZU's Jeremiah Edding spoke with Dr. Alan Radner, the chief medical officer at Salinas Valley Memorial Healthcare System, and he's an infectious disease specialist.
We're definitely experiencing a surge right now. We're seeing considerably more patients who are testing positive, more patients are in emergency room, and more patients being hospitalized. The one thing that's very clear is that the Delta variant is extremely infectious. I think with these variants now being so contagious, most of us believe that you've got two choices now. You can either get vaccinated or you can get COVID. Very few people are going to be able to dodge one or the other at this point in time.
Given all that, what's the capacity at Salinas Valley Memorial, and how concerned are you about reaching capacity?
The large percentage of the people in Monterey County who were at risk for becoming critically ill were immunosuppressed or older individuals, and a majority of them have been vaccinated. So we think there's going to be a lot of people infected. We don't think we're going to overrun the hospitals. We hope we won't. But again, there's a lot of issues there. In December and January, there wasn't any way to prevent the horrors that we were seeing in the hospital. It's frustrating now because we think a lot of these are preventable with vaccination.
Right. There's a lot of frustration right now directed towards unvaccinated people for prolonging the pandemic. And I wonder what your thoughts are on the characterization that this is now a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Right. There's people who are legitimately scared. I think we can try to convince people who are scared as best we can with more and more evidence. I mean, every scientist that I know, every medical society, infectious disease society, almost all the doctors in the United States are getting vaccinated. And there's literally been a couple billion doses of this vaccine that's been administered throughout the world now. And it's incredibly unusual to see complications from the vaccine.
Do you have any advice for people who might have an unvaccinated friend or family member who's hesitant?
I would really encourage them to talk to their doctor. I'd be shocked if any doctor in Monterey County is not going to strongly encourage them to get vaccinated. The risk of having a serious reaction to the vaccine is like 2 in a million. You know, your choice is you can get vaccinated, which has almost no risk, or you can get sick, which has a significant risk. And if you're vaccinated and get sick right now nationally, the people who get COVID that have been vaccinated, it's extremely unusual for you to be hospitalized. It's something like 97, 98% of the people who've been hospitalized in the United States right now are unvaccinated. You may become an asymptomatic shedder or have a very mild illness, but I would greatly prefer to have that than the risks of developing severe respiratory illness, requiring hospitalization, potentially dying, and having a much higher likelihood of developing long haulers, you know, long-term manifestations.
There was a recent recommendation from all the health officers in the Monterey Bay area to start wearing masks in public spaces, even if people are vaccinated. And then the CDC made a similar recommendation. I wonder who you think in this area should be wearing masks. Should all of us be wearing masks? And in what situations is it safe to go without one?
I think there's convincing evidence that masks help. They're not perfect. They're not as good as vaccines, but they definitely help. Everyone gets frustrated that recommendations change. And I mean, the virus is changing literally. The Delta variant is behaving different than earlier variants. Science is changing. We're understanding it better. We're seeing surges or anticipated surges. The CDC is changing the recommendations. So that's really difficult and frustrating for everyone. But we know a lot of people aren't vaccinated, and many of those people aren't wearing masks. For all of us, the safest thing to do is when we're indoors is to wear a mask. But these are really difficult individual and community and county and societal questions.
So I wonder, is there anything that you feel optimistic about or hopeful about?
We're hopeful that our hospital surges, the number of people critically ill and the people that are hospitalized, isn't going to be what we saw with the previous surges. And we're hopeful that we can get this under control soon. So there's definitely good news. You know, vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. That's our message right now.
That was Dr. Alan Radner, the chief medical officer at Salinas Valley Memorial Healthcare System, speaking with KAZU's Jeremiah Edding. It's been more than 100 years since the 1906 earthquake that caused severe damage to San Francisco. Since then, Californians have long anticipated another big one to hit along the San Andreas Fault. KCBX's Sophie Lincoln spoke to local experts about the probability of such an earthquake and its potential damage to the Central Coast.
Seismologists say the big one is only a matter of time.
Be prepared when the big one hits.
Are you covered when the next big one hits?
Are we ready for the big one?
Oh, of course not.
Here in California, the hypothetical big one has loomed over us for many years. Based on seismic history and current data on the earthquake cycle, it's widely anticipated that the next big one will hit Southern California. According to Cal Poly geology professor John Jasbinsek, since earthquakes do not follow a strict cycle, it's difficult to predict when exactly an earthquake may hit. Jasbinsek says paleoseismologists have hypothesized that the next big one along the San Andreas Fault will have a magnitude of around 7 or 7.5, which is slightly less than the 1906 earthquake's magnitude of 7.9.
It would still be a devastating event.
Of course, local damage would depend on the epicenter of the earthquake. If an earthquake occurs in the Bay Area, impacts to the Central Coast would be smaller. But if it happens in the Central Valley, impacts could be much larger. In terms of the potential damage of this hypothetical earthquake, Cal Poly Geotechnical Engineering Professor Rob Moss says ground damage, liquefaction, and disruption of electricity are among the potential effects of such a large earthquake. Liquefaction refers to solid ground becoming more liquid due to stress from ground accelerations during an earthquake. According to Moss, the Central Coast and California overall have strict building codes that are meant to prevent collapses during an earthquake.
In California, we have the best building codes in the world, and it's twofold. You have to have building codes and you have to have enforcement. And so that's part of the preparedness. It's long-term planning, good building codes, good enforcement, and then personal responsibility.
Besides building codes, San Luis Obispo County has an emergency plan in place. But San Luis Obispo County Emergency Services Manager Scott Jalbert says it would take roughly 72 hours for regional, federal, and state assistance to arrive after an earthquake.
But probably the more important thing is that the citizens need to know that they may be on their own for up to 3 days and they need to be prepared.
Other measures the county has taken to prepare include identifying target hazards, key infrastructure, and making sure that hospitals have backup generators. Cal Poly also has its own emergency management director, Anthony Knight, who is in charge of planning, preparation, outreach, and response for all hazards that might affect the campus community.
We need to do risk assessments and hazard vulnerability assessments to determine what our threats are here at Cal Poly. One of those being an earthquake, right? In California, it's one of our major seasons, fire, flood, wind, and earthquakes.
Cal Poly has its own emergency operations plan, and preparation measures and information can be found online at emergency.calpoly.edu. Knight advises being prepared by storing water and food, as earthquakes can disrupt power and water lines. To prepare an earthquake emergency kit, visit prepareslow.org. For KCBX News, I'm Sophie Lincoln.
It's time now for the nonprofit story.
I'm Dr. Consuelo Mukes, your host. El Camino Homeless Organization, known as ECHO, has been in our community for many years. And in fact, it's celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. This is a transitional homeless shelter that helps people who are homeless in our community. Today, we have Wendy Lewis, the executive director, to tell us all about El Camino Homeless Organization. Wendy, welcome to the nonprofit story.
Well, thank you for having me. This is a pleasure to share about what we do.
Absolutely. Well, ECHO is known by many in our county and community, but some are not familiar. But I don't think all of us understand the history of ECHO and the work that you've done over the years. So start us off by telling us about that.
Yeah, I still am amazed. Each day I walk into our facilities and kind of just realize what the founding folks did. 20 years ago, really in North County in San Luis Obispo, there really weren't any services for the unhoused. And some really dedicated and caring people said, you know, we need to do something. Let's step up. And they started with a meal program. And they would move the meals. They were donated from community members and churches. And they would move every couple months from church to church and serve that meal, which is just a basic way to really get people nutrition and start that caring and showing compassion. And unfortunately, as the face of homelessness changed back then, it was, you know, kind of the chronic male on the street. There was a need for shelter. And so they worked with churches, local churches, and they would have a program where they would house people overnight. Now you compare that to kind of today's warming shelters, warming centers, where it's just really you come in for a meal, you have a safe place to stay overnight, and then you leave in the morning. And as homelessness continued to change, and we saw more of women, children, seniors, veterans, they really started to expand our organization. And we were able to acquire our first physical shelter, which was in Atascadero, and that remains our hub today.
So let's talk a bit about the look of homelessness in our county, because we know that this is a beautiful county by the beach. We have a great area. But what's the reality of homelessness in our area?
You know, I've been in this work for about 3.5 years. And even though I worked in nonprofits for many, many years, I really, you know, you always hear anybody can experience homelessness. And until I really lived this work, found that that is a true reality. I have seen some tragic events that have led somebody who was very stable, who had kind of, you know, our what we think of as a great life, that just a tragic event or a circumstance kind of led a spiral and caused them to lose housing. So it really can affect anybody. In the past few years, I've definitely seen an increase in fragile seniors. That has been just a really growing need. Our housing prices in our community are so high. And unfortunately, if they're on a fixed income, they're just not matching up. And you know, I've witnessed, you know, people who are in their 70s and 80s, they have a major medical crisis, they end up in the hospital for a few months. And by the time they're out, they have lost housing and have no place to go. And ECHO becomes their safety net, similar to families where families with children and a parent loses employment. And, you know, they're living paycheck to paycheck. And all of a sudden, they're at our doors needing our services. So really, is a wide spectrum. Really anybody at some point in their life, sadly, could turn to ECHO and need our support.
And with ECHO being a transitional homeless shelter, how does that actually work? In other words, when people are finding themselves without a place to stay, how do they qualify to be in the shelter? How long can they stay?
Yeah, so we've really grown over our 20 years and really evolved with the need. And we have now a wide spectrum of help and opportunity for people depending on the path they're on. So we now, with our new facility in Paso Robles, have a true emergency shelter for that person who needs that first step into stability. It's a kind of a night by night. But we also have, which we have in Atascadero, a program-based opportunity, which means somebody comes to us, they work with our case management team, they're ready to really work through a case plan that's tailored to them. And with that commitment, then ECHO becomes their home for at least 90 days. They have the stability. They know they can come back to the same bed and really have the support from our team, really, to get them back into housing. And that's our goal. We want to work with all of our folks to get them back into housing, because we know how much trauma being unhoused causes folks. And if we can help them gain that stability, we're saving that long-term trauma from being chronically unhoused.
And I hear you have like 140 beds. Is that correct?
Yeah. So if you would have asked me about a year and a half ago how many beds we had, we actually had 50 not so long ago. And as we work to really meet the unmet needs, some opportunities came to us to really help us expand and really provide more resources. So in our original Atascadero ECHO, we have now done a construction project to rehab the building and can offer 60 beds. We now have ECHO Paso Robles, which is a new resource that, through a partnership with Haslow and People's Self-Help Housing, came online about 8 months ago. And then during the winter here in Atascadero, last year, we had an organization who had been providing in Atascadero a warming shelter when weather was incrementally bad during the winter, and their capacity shifted. So they asked us to take it on. And again, our team was like, oh gosh, we've got a full plate during a pandemic. We're expanding, but we really couldn't say no because it's such a critical need. And we looked at it a little differently. We actually offered it consistently from the beginning of November to the end of March every night so that we would really offer that stability. And we saw just amazing changes in people that were more of the chronically unhoused. And so with the combination of those three, that's the 140 beds.
Have you been growing even during this COVID period? I would think maybe you might have found an even greater need.
We really did. We saw people who just would not have experienced being unhoused had they not had a tragedy through COVID. And we were able to support them really when there weren't other resources for that. We also have a partnership with Must Charities and Paso Wine Alliance, where we have a COVID relief community fund that we're able to support people in rapid rehousing and or getting them the stability they need. So that's been a great program to have and really help people who are affected by COVID. Looming out there with kind of the uptick, you know, I think see more on the horizon. And so we're looking at that as well.
Mm-hmm. So you sound like you work with a lot of different partners. Is that a way that you're able to have good services and expand what you do?
It really is. We strongly believe in collaboration and partnership and non-duplication of services. It's really, you know, if someone else is doing it well, let's partner with them and bring that resource to our folks that we're serving. And so we partner with agencies like Transitions Mental Health to bring in some mental health support. We partner with, again, like our Peoples and Haslow and just entities that really can bring their knowledge base and their resource partnerships through Community Foundation and Slo County Office of Education for reading programs for our children and just really looking at it as holistically and supportive as possible.
If you are just joining us, this is Dr. Consuelo Mukes with The Nonprofit Story. I'm speaking with Wendy Lewis, the Executive Director of El Camino Homeless Organization, known as ECHO, in our county. Wendy, again, congratulations on being named one of the nonprofits of the year by Senator John Laird and others. I think that's a really big honor. Tell us just briefly about what that means for you.
I was on a Sunday evening, just kind of relaxing, and my phone rings, and I look down, and it's Senator Laird himself. He personally reached out and shared with us that he watched our story, and he actually came for a visit about a year and a half ago and really sat and learned a lot about what we did for hours, took a tour, and he just said he just was kind of in awe of all this growth and what we were able to do during a pandemic and just really saw the transformational change we're able to help people with. And again, he's in, I think, three counties and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of nonprofits. It was such an honor.
Let's talk a little more about the services that are actually offered and a little bit about the Paso Robles location, which is brand new. So when somebody comes to your shelter, one of your shelters, what is their experience?
What makes us really extra special is we really look at each individual as a human being and really what they need and what care can we provide, what resources can we provide. So it looks a little differently depending on the location. But again, both programs have the 90 days now and some emergency sheltering. So it depends on what that person is looking for. So if someone just needs to come in and have an evening meal, that's offered in both locations. If someone means a shower and hygiene, we have that as well. But if somebody is ready for that next step, that's when case management tailors a case plan for them and really connects them to what's needed. So employment, financial literacy, parenting classes for the adults, job placement, workforce development, to really what that person's need is. For the children, we offer reading, as I mentioned, and garden education and art and tutoring and support. So it really is wrapping kind of our arms around their journey. If somebody is in Paso Robles and coming for our services, the funding was state funding through the HEAP program. And that funding actually has us prioritizing who we serve. And so families with children are prioritized, as well as people who are most susceptible to COVID. So if they're in that category, they're pretty much guaranteed one of our currently 45 beds. If someone is not in that category, they're put in a lottery, and sadly, we're full every single night. We will be able to expand to 60 beds post-COVID, but right now we just have some extra precautions in place. So it is amazing that we're there, but also kind of daunting the fact that, you know, we're full every night and so many people are being turned away.
Wow, that is something. I guess, are people just having to go back out into the environment, I guess, and find a place to try to stay safe? Are you able to offer them food at least?
The meals at both locations are open to anybody who is hungry. It can also be a resource to help people keep people housed if they're kind of living paycheck to paycheck and they need a meal, you know, they're welcome. And those meals are brought in from the caring community. And again, through partnerships. I mean, that's every evening, a group or a community nonprofit or somebody brings in a meal at both locations for about 60 people. If they aren't able to stay with us, they are also able to have showers and still get connected to resources. You know, since opening in Paso Robles about 8 months ago, we've seen over 500 unduplicated people. That just really points out that gap. You know, we're coming in to bring the first ever resources for the unhoused up there for actual shelter, but there's still that huge gap.
That's amazing. You know, I've had the opportunity to come in and work with the feeding program as far as serving. It used to be where you could actually serve the meals. And I would think you're not able to actually serve right now, or are you? Can people actually come in, or are they giving takeaway meals?
So at both locations, depending on how we're serving, in Paso Robles, it's actually kind of in an open air area in our facility. So currently right now, folks are still able to serve the meal they bring in Atascadero, because our kitchen is more of a congregate setting. They're actually, we're serving in a to-go style for those that aren't staying with us, and they're taking it with them. So, you know, we're adapting with COVID. We've been working with public health since day one and just really trying to make sure we're able to keep everybody safe as we can.
I noticed on your website the story of a family of five. Is it more common today to maybe see families who are homeless? How are the children able to get their actual schooling, especially during this sheltering?
I would say those faces changed about 5 years ago. We've always served families, but there was really a significant uptick. And what makes us special is that we're able at both locations to keep those families together, kind of traditional sheltering. Men go one way and women and children go the other. And here you're in a crisis and your partner that's trying to support you is not there with you. So really, I think keeping the families together is just such an important piece of what we do. And we also work with the local school districts and McKinney-Vento folks to really make sure the kids still get to thrive and be part of schoolwork. During COVID, we partnered and had stations brought in so the kids could do the in-home learning, just like a regular child. And that's really kind of what we strive, is to really create an environment for them where they're not feeling like they're so much different than the kids that they're in school with.
It's wonderful that you're creating this home and safe atmosphere for people who would really be going through a lot of trauma during this period of time. I'm just wondering, again, how it's done. I know you have an incredible staff over there, but what are the needs for volunteers?
Yeah, volunteers are a huge piece of our work. At both locations, it takes about 300 volunteers monthly in order to provide the safe and stable services we do. And during the summer, it's kind of in a critical point because lots of our folks, you know, are traveling or they're just have other things. And so it's really an urgent need right now, mm-hmm. especially for our overnight chaperones. Nightly, we have folks that stay overnight and just help support our services during the evening. And so, yeah, volunteers are critical. Folks can find out information on our website, which is echoshelter.org, about volunteering and just more about us as well.
Wendy, what if people wanted to help with donations? How can the community really help ECHO?
We keep a current list on our website because those needs change depending on the time of year and the season. But we always need like new towels or gently used towels for our shower programs and toiletries, things that really can provide help us provide that hygiene. We really try to manage our clothing donations because we don't want to take something we can't really utilize. So that's why we change that list pretty often. And just other support you mentioned financially, we just really, it takes the community to help us provide this work. And, you know, over the 20 years, it wouldn't have been possible without the caring community. And it results in transformational change. In Paso Robles alone, since we've been opened, over 40 individuals and family have been helped back into housing. That would not have been possible without this project. And again, that's really what we strive to do, is really housing is key. Getting them back in is really our goal.
Do you ever have any fundraisers?
We have three kind of flagship ones each year, and Empty Bowls is in April, and that I just encourage people to kind of watch for that coming next year. And coming up soon is Long Walk Home, and that starts in Atascadero. It's on September 25th, and it's an opportunity for the community to come together and show that they support the folks we serve. And so they walk alongside that people we serve, and nobody knows who's different or who's unhoused. It's just all coming together. We have a nice barbecue, and it's just a really an awareness and fundraising walk. And last one we had in person, which was a couple years ago, we walked from Atascadero Echo through our downtown in Atascadero, and we saw some folks that were unhoused on the streets, and one of them was like, "What's going on?" And I'm like, "Oh, we're walking to support our unhoused community." And he said, "This many people really care?" And I'm like, "Oh, that's really kind of what we try to do, is show we care."
Give us the website again so people can find out how to help.
Echoshelter.org, which is echoshelter.org. They can go there to learn more about our services if they're in need of them, learn how to volunteer, donate, come to an event or sponsor an event. It's all right there.
Again, congratulations on your 20th anniversary of serving this community, Wendy.
Thank you so much for reaching out and making this possible.
You're so welcome. This is The Nonprofit Story. I'm Dr. Consuelo Mewkes. We've been talking with Wendy Lewis, Executive Director of El Camino Homeless Organization, known as ECHO, in our community.
And now, Working Lunch.
Welcome to Working Lunch, the Slow Chambers weekly series where we connect with our community leaders and get to know the person behind the position. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the Slow Chamber, and today you'll get to be a part of my conversation with First District Supervisor John Pashong. Supervisor Pashong is currently serving his second four-year term representing the city of Paso Robles, as well as the communities of Templeton, Adelaida, Roblar, Heritage Ranch, San Miguel, Shandon, and Oak Shores in North County. Supervisor Pashong honed his skills in politics and media while working in the White House during the Reagan administration and later as the executive director for the California Republican Party. As County Supervisor John served two consecutive years as chair, I'm looking forward to learning more about the supervisor's past political work, timely issues including redistricting, the appointment of a new clerk recorder, and diving into the opportunities he sees for our county's future. Mr. Supervisor, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
I'd love to know what initially got you on the path of being in politics and public policy. Was there a particular issue or person who piqued your interest?
My first election that I participated in as an 18-year-old was in 1980, and I voted for President Reagan. I'm a third-generation Angeleno from down south originally, but I've been here over 20 years. My wife and I moved up here, and we've had our kids here and raised them. And I will tell you that right after college, and I moved to Washington, D.C., and I did get a job at the White House in the second Reagan administration. And quite frankly, I did spend some time with the president. I have a communications background, radio and television. And so I did work with him at the White House and also up at Camp David. And I did some speeches at the UN and things like that. And I got kind of a real taste for the power of words and the power of being able to talk issues and ideas. And that kind of got me excited. I've been working in the campaign field for a long time. I enjoy the ability to be able to tell people's stories. And that's what I do. I tell their story to the public through direct voter contact programs. I've done that here in this county, though I have not done any of those races since I was elected. Gave up a number of clients that we had here, but I have really kind of focused on issues and ideas on how to make life better for people in our community. And that to me is what this is about. This isn't about the fighting over you know, how we're going to spend money. This is about what that money will actually do to the community, because we have some very serious problems. And we've had, you know, and I want to say over the last, since the pandemic, you know, we've gotten really focused on some of those, like the homeless issue in the community and some other things. But to me, this job and being elected right now in this country, any of the local elected official jobs, is really about, you know, helping people improve their lives and the lives of their families. And so that's why I got into it. And I continue to try to fight for those things that I believe in that will help make it easier and better, a better place for San Luis Obispo County, a better place in my district to live and raise a family and work.
You know, going from that transition from behind the scenes and working on the speeches for someone else and giving it to then now having to do your own, was there anything that surprised you once you were the person sitting in the seat?
You know, it's interesting because one of the people that I respected the most in the Reagan administration was Judge Bill Clark, who lived in North San Luis Obispo County in Shandon. And probably some of you have been to the chapel that he built out on his ranch on Chapel Hill outside of Shandon. That's one of the reasons why we live here, is that I was visiting with him. And I mean, he really did kind of open my eyes to the possibilities of being able to do the work that I do at the time and still live in some place that I wanted to live, which is here. But I will tell you, I think the one thing that is different, I expected it, but I didn't expect it to the degree, is the amount of animosity that different political parties, that different folks actually have toward each other. I understand when you have opposing views that you can have respectful arguments about those and the direction you need to go in. But what I was initially surprised with was it got so personal so fast. And all of a sudden, things that would never be acceptable for people to say to an elected official, they were saying. And we've seen this continue. And it's one of the reasons why we came together when I was first chairman and assigned the code of civility with the seven cities and the county to try to get people to understand that there is more than just calling your neighbor or somebody that you know a nasty name, that there's actually discussions that you can have, and you can actually have debates on issues and ideas to be able to come to the best resolution possible for the county. My ideas, some of them are perfect, but a lot of them need some work on them, right? And the only way to do that is to debate them and have discussions and make some changes and bring people together around them and build a coalition of support. And that coalition of support, and so, you know, you want to be able to do that. I come down a lot of times in trying to figure out ways to make sure that we can bring people together behind the policies. And if that takes me having to change something or add something because somebody has said, you know, hey, this is not right, I want to discuss it with you, I have something that we could tweak it to make a little bit better. Frank Meacham, who was worked for the county and before me for 8 years as supervisor, and then he was the mayor of Paso Robles. He made this statement right when he was first elected, and people were arguing with him about a policy. And he said, look, if this policy doesn't work or it has problems, we will fix it. That's the nature of public policy, is you make changes. And they do that in Washington, D.C. They do that in Sacramento. And we do it here in San Luis Obispo County. So a lot of times we're making policy based on where we believe we are currently at the time. And things change, as everybody knows, the community changes. I mean, nobody 2 years ago, nobody would have thought that we were going to be going into a global pandemic and we were going to be shutting down businesses and not letting people. And, you know, nobody also thought we would have a vaccine as fast as we had the vaccine. So, I mean, there's a lot of kind of give and take there, and the world changes. And so you need to adapt, improvise, and overcome on a lot of times.
really agree with you 100%. You were there in Washington, D.C., where you had a Ronald Reagan and a Tip O'Neill. They would go and figure these things out. They didn't have to agree, but they had a good conversation. They solved problems. Ted Kennedy and the right would get together, right? Have dinner together and solve issues. And we're just not seeing that. It is a huge problem for how we want to move our society forward at all levels.
And not hate each other. I mean, you know, there was a statement, I think if I get it right, Reagan said, if I disagree with you 20% of the time, you're not 20% my enemy, you're 80% my friend. And it's one of the reasons why I meet with Don Ortiz Legge. I meet certainly with Bruce Gibson. You know, I sit down with Lynn and Debbie on different issues. You know, we talk about them all the time. And I don't always agree with everybody. I mean, you've seen our meetings. And that's what elective government is about. That's what our democracy is about. And so I think that, you know, continuing to do that, to try to get input from all sides. I mean, I certainly did it when I wrote my columns for the San Luis Obispo County Tribune. And I do this when I talk to people in the community. And so the ability to be able to listen, actively listen to people and their ideas, I think is something that I've embraced from Washington, D.C. And I'm from California state government when I worked through the party system here in California. And remember, you know, it wasn't always this blue of a state. Back in 1994, and I worked at the California Republican Party as the executive director, but the state, we had 5 of the 7 statewide constitutional officers. We had control of the congressional delegation with the majority of the congressional delegation. And we actually had control of the state assembly. So, you know, we have fallen, you know, in recent years, but these are cycles. I've always believed that. And they do fluctuate, you know, because it does come down to who has the best ideas that can capture the imagination of the voting population.
Yeah, it's a great point. I went to Sacramento State as a family of Democrats. We had gone up there. I thought I was going to get a job in the Capitol right about that time that Brulte and Pringle and Wilson, there weren't any Democratic jobs. But I wanted to say, you know, just from my own perspective, that I've always appreciated being able to come and talk to you directly about issues, whether we agree exactly on them or not, and you can share why you're voting your way and I'm sharing our position. But I've always appreciated that the way you've been open to those conversations.
You know, it's the simplest thing sometimes. It shouldn't be a tough one to fix. And the example I'll give you is this last week. So last year, we had to cut a budget, and I don't cut law enforcement. I'm not into the defund the police or the sheriff's movement. I support law enforcement. And so we kept law enforcement the same, but we did have to cut other departments. And what happened was, because of COVID and the pandemic, the money was cut from our community pools. And we just got some money restored to the community pools at the last meeting. And so we're going to be able to, here in August, we're opening up, and I have 3 of the pools that are on the list for the recreation folks, you know, are in my district, San Miguel, Shannon, and Templeton. And they have been closed for 1.5 years. And these kids, if you've been to Shannon or you've been to San Miguel, you know, the pool is one of the things that the children really look forward to. So we restored some funding to find some lifeguards. And luckily, Nick, who runs the rec folks, he was able to find somebody to help train some lifeguards. And so we've been able to now open these pools in the hottest month that we have to be able to give some to relief and something fun for these kids to do. And to me, I will tell you this straight up. When I would visit those communities, that was one of the things that everybody talked about. You know, when are you going to open the pool? When are you going to do this? Now, there were medical reasons not to open the pool last year with COVID, but this year we're able to do it. They're open, and we have limited hours, and we have funding restored for next year too, so we'll be able to open up the full season. But to me, these are the things that county government does right, and we can't, you know, if you're a young person growing up in Shandon or San Miguel or Templeton, and you don't have access to another pool, this is, you know, this is something you look forward to. Why are we kind of taking away one of the highlights of the summer months by taking their pool away, you know, when we are spending all kinds of other money on other things? So I think that's one of the things that I'm proudest of this year, is being able to kind of really help those kids in those communities.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. The SLO Chamber's Jim D'Antona is speaking with SLO County's 1st District Supervisor, John Pichong.
The county is currently in the process of finding and appointing a new clerk recorder, and that will involve public interviews for the final group. Maybe if you could share some insights into what you're listening for when you're looking for a new clerk recorder.
So the thing is, there's two ways to do this. The county board just comes in and appoints somebody, or there's a process. And the process has kind of been set up by two counties, but the first one was Contra Costa County. They lost their clerk recorder a few years ago. And so they set up a process that they called open and transparent, where they do this interview process. So anybody can apply, and they apply. They're going to go through a preliminary discussion with a panel of five people. Each supervisor has appointed one of those five people, and they're going to talk to everybody, and they're going to push forward probably five to seven of the most qualified people. They'll come before the board. This has to be done in public. So this can't be done, you know, in a conference room quietly. This has to be done in front of the public. So the cameras will be on and we'll have a full meeting. And it'll be an open and transparent process where we interview those 5 to 7 people. If we don't find any of them that we believe are qualified, we can't agree on it or for a majority vote, then, you know, they can go back out and they can ask for more resumes to come in and more people to apply. I think because I've gotten a number of calls from deputy county clerk recorders around the state that there are people that are interested in applying for the job. I believe there's probably people in our own office downstairs that are interested in applying for the job. I think the job pays like $150,000 a year. It's a decent job. You don't have to run for re-election. That election will be next year. So you don't have to run for re-election if you don't want, but if you want to, that, you know, and you get put into this position, that's certainly available. But the key component was that it's going to be open and transparent in front of everybody. I can't in good conscience say, I'm just going to pick somebody. That's not the way I work, because, you know, I don't want to, you know, pick winners and losers here. And there's a lot of people that have said they're very, very interested. And if we do this in public, I think we're going to have some very qualified candidates, and everybody will get a chance to see who they are, what they believe in, you know, what they think their skill set they can bring to this job. It's a tough job. The job, you know, certainly during the election cycle, this job is on the front lines of, you know, and you've seen some of the things. And by the way, I really like Tommy Gong. I wish he hadn't resigned and moved to Contra Costa County to be the deputy there. I've always gotten along with him and his family. They're wonderful people. They lived in North County, and I thought he did a very good job. So and all the stuff that has come out, you know, since then, or people that have been screaming about the job he did, I disagree with them on that. But he did make a decision for his family to take his family to Contra Costa County, and I wish him the best up there. And I know he's going to be successful there. So I think that from my standpoint, though, you know, we there was a whole discussion on putting some different qualifications on the position. And I don't agree with that, because if they're not qualifications that the voters vote on, and some of the jobs here that are elected, you have to have certain qualifications to, you know, certain degrees or professional service or professional society membership or whatever it would be. I understand, but in this particular instance, there aren't any. So I'm not going to add any additional things that John Pashon thinks that they need to be on there so I can narrow the field down so I can get my own person in there. I would like to have an open and transparent process and let the best person apply for the job and let the best person take the job and do a good job in this upcoming election. Now, it won't happen before the recall election. That will be coming up on September 14th. So it'll probably be right after that. We do have our next election until the legislature changes it. Our next election will be in June of next year. The filing period will be opening up sometime in February for the other positions. And so if you have an interest in running, that's for a county job. That's when and you can do that. I'm actually not running for re-election. I said I would do two terms. And so two terms will be up for me on December 31st, 2024. But you're going to need to run probably in June or March, whenever the legislature calls that election, for my position, if you want to be the first district supervisor.
And that's when you have redistricting for supervisorial districts coming up. Yes. And I know you've probably been involved before from the backside, being in the elected official seat. Do you see that's going to change your role?
Well, there are state laws that govern redistricting in counties, and there's going to be five public meetings. We've held our first, so there's four more that everybody can participate in. To me, that's the difference, is that I'll be listening to those meetings and hearing what people say, what part of the community they want to be in, what supervisorial district they might want to be in. We have had some growth, as you know, and we've got some different things that we're going to have to deal with, but the data hasn't been released yet. That's the thing that really is kind of hurting our efforts so far, is that the census data has not been released by the federal government. Now, I'm being told that it's sometime in August, maybe August 13th, it'll be released. We'll all have a chance to look at lines. There's going to be some movement on some of these district lines. I can tell you that the population in my district, 50% of the district is the city of Paso Robles and 50% is outside. I'm actually one of the first supervisors that was not elected from the city of Paso Robles. I think that there's going to be, you know, some movement. Templeton may not be in the district, you know, when this is over, because population has grown in the northern part. But there's not a lot of wiggle room for the first district, because you're up against Monterey County, Kings County, and Kern County. So you're kind of, you know, I think where the movement will probably be here in the city of San Luis Obispo. There's going to be, you know, right now, currently the city of San Luis Obispo is covered by three supervisors. It may end up being two supervisors, may end up being one supervisor. You know, as you see the demographics and the people move in different areas, you know, there's a lot of new housing being built here too. So you're going to take, you know, the new houses that have already been built and people have moved in and registered. So you're going to have to take that into account too. But I, you know, the two districts that are tougher to move around are District 4, which is Lynn Compton, because she butts up down there against Santa Barbara County. And I actually think a portion of Ventura County way over there in their kind of east side or something like that. But I will tell you that I think that it's going to be an open and transparent process. It has to be by law. We're going to take in all different communities and their wants and needs. We did send a letter on a statewide redistricting to the redistricting commission that was a ballot initiative that put that in place. And we asked that San Luis Obispo not be divided in half. There was movement 10 years ago to divide for the assembly and the Senate seat at the Cuesta grade. So we'd go north and they go south and cut us up. I think we're stronger when we have one person in charge of the county of San Luis Obispo in the assembly and one in the state Senate. As you know, we have Jordan Cunningham in the assembly and John Laird in before him, Bill Monning. And it was easy for me to be able to communicate with them the wants and needs of my constituents and talk to them about the things that they were doing. And I hope that we're able to keep that. And then they also will decide the congressional district. And as you know, we are in Salud Carbajal's district, who lives down in Santa Barbara County. And he's got a small portion of Ventura in his district, all of Santa Barbara County, and all of San Luis Obispo County. Now, we did lose a congressional seat, though, this year because of the decline in population in the state of California. So that's going to change some things. There are going to be some lines moving. I don't know if they'll be here on the Central Coast, but someplace there's going to be some movement on this.
We at the Chamber support you 100% in what you were talking about from the statewide, that slow county should not be broken up, that we stick together. So again, but that's a whole separate redistricting process, which is really convoluted, but you know, obviously we're encouraging everybody to be involved in that. And we think this is another great place to come see the process. It happens once every 10 years. If folks want to get in touch and maybe have a conversation without attacking anyone, is there a good way to reach out to your office?
They can just call me on my cell phone, which I've been giving out. Just the funny story is I've been giving out this cell phone number during my campaign. I put it on 250,000 pieces of political mail, and I got three calls in an election cycle. So you call me at 805-440-7818. You can leave a message for me. You can text me at that number, by the way. Just let me know who you are, because sometimes I'll get some interesting texts, you know, in the middle of the night, you know, usually when the bars close about 2 o'clock in the morning. But, you know, that's OK. This is the job I signed up for and I enjoy it. And I'd love to talk to anybody, you know, who has it. So it's 805-440-7818.
That is amazing and incredibly brave. I'll tell you, that's a true elected official of the people. Mr. Supervisor, thank you so much for spending the time with us, making some time to talk with our listeners, and really do appreciate all the work you're doing.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
That was the San Luis Obispo Chamber's Executive Director, Jim D'Antona, speaking with San Luis Obispo County's First District Supervisor, John Pichon. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.